of sense. The open line is 822-3000. Let's catch up with one of our friends of the show, Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council. Hello, Craig.
G'day, Jeff.
You doing well?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Jeff.
What would you do about... I mean, you're based in Melbourne. You have your fair share of Hoon drivers over there. Well, what's the answer to Hoon drivers, Craig?
Well, it tends to be getting a lot worse than it used to be.
Yeah.
I just think the penalties have to be enforced, basically. I don't think taking cars off people and crushing them is the idea. But just enforce the penalties.
Mm. You know, car crushing does work.
Does it?
Yes.
No, have you had yours crushed lately?
Well, no, they've got no need, except for driving too slow, if there's a penalty.
Okay.
But they did it in Canada. They had a massive run of Hoon driving and street racing deaths. And then they thought, enough's enough, and they brought in, okay, we'll crush your car. If you get done for the street racing sort of stuff, which has just happened here in Adelaide, and someone got caught up in it and died. Not one of the street racers, someone else.
Well, it's a question of how powerful the cars are that young people actually get.
Well, that's true. Well, anyway, they brought in the car crushing. They didn't have to crush many. And the deaths went from, six a year to zil, nil, nothing. And, I don't know, proof positive.
Yeah, right.
Why not crush the odd car? Save a lot of lives that way. Don't have a problem with that.
Sounds like it.
Hmm. Now, last time we spoke, we talked about the train that never stopped.
Yes, we did.
An amazing little concept. I like this. It's a Chinese one. It's something they've actually come up with themselves, which is, that's new.
Because normally
they copy everyone else's ideas.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've got these bullet trains over there, which now go, 300 miles an hour, incredible speed. And when these trains operate, the biggest cost of power and time is when they've got to slow down and then stop, wait for elderly people to get on, or even normal people to get on, and take off again.
Mm.
A huge amount of energy that gets wasted. And, if you stop at, say, for 5 minutes or a bit longer at each station, then you've got 30 stations between two points on the on your destination. That's 2.5 hours of just waiting.
Mm.
So what the Chinese have come up with is an idea, why don't we have a system where the train doesn't actually have to stop? And they've got this concept where you have these carriages that sit actually on top of the train. Now, at a station, there's always one carriage at the front of a set of rails that are up off the ground so the train can go underneath it. But people actually, at their leisure, hop into this carriage. And so when the train comes along, it picks up the front carriage with people ready to get on the train, but at the same time, it offloads a carriage that's already sitting at the back of the train with people in it to get off. So as the train goes along, the front carriage gets loaded onto the train, and then the back carriage gets swept onto the, picked up onto the rails, and the people just hop off the train at their leisure. Once the train's got the carriage on the top from going past the station, it can then start to accelerate. The people then go from the front of the train, go into the train, they get down off the carriage, and then that train carriage rolls back to the back of the train again, and people are disembarking, get into the carriage again, and the whole thing works like clockwork without even stopping.
Goes forever.
Well, it could, but train drivers have to be in a loop then.
I know. But what you do save is a whole lot of downtime and probably a whole lot of energy too, in terms of the extra energy it takes to pick up speed.
Yeah, well, that's the whole idea of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting idea. It's there's actually, I don't know whether, did you put that on your, I think I sent you a link of actually a video file of that.
Yeah, I watched that. Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe if you've got space on your website, put it up there and people can have a look at it. Mm. It's really quite an interesting idea.
Given
how big our country is, I mean, we need a few of these very high-speed trains all over the place, rather than just relying on, airplane travel.
Hmm.
I mean, you take Sydney to Melbourne or even Melbourne to Adelaide, they're just beautiful distances for a high-speed train. And we would say magnetic levitation trains are double-tracked and develop the technology here in Australia. And it means you can get from Melbourne to Sydney in about 2 hours. Actually, it would be less time than flying. I mean, the time you have to get full security and
Yeah. I can't imagine you have to be body scanned and body cavity searched going on a train like you have to these days.
Because what is it going to do? Fall off the maglev wraps around the track, so it can't fall off.
It's got nowhere to go.
Well, it's nowhere to go. I mean, it's the only thing you can do is the magnetic system breaks down, it plops on the rails. I mean, it's all reinforced concrete and steel.
I wondered what happened, because a little while ago, it might have been a year or two ago, they were talking about, okay, it's time for the age of rail. You know, we need stuff. We're in a society where we want to be able to click on something on the internet, put in an order, and expect it to up tomorrow. You know, that's not going to change anytime soon. So we're that, you know, want it now world. So the transport industry is just going to get more manic than anything else. Roads are bursting at the seams, and the answer is to, and while they've neglected rail for a long time, okay, it's time for the age of rail. Let's do something with rail again. And, well, nothing happened. That was it.
One of the reasons for that, Jeff, is it's all tied to the financial system. And as you know from the Alice Springs to Darwin Railroad, I mean, I think that's just been sold recently, but it actually went broke. It couldn't fund the money that it took to build it. It's a good idea.
Well, it was making money. If you didn't have the debt burden behind it, it was fine. They just couldn't, you know, pay the interest bill.
And that's where the problem of the entire financial system is today. It's all based upon private central banking methods, which require servicing huge debts.
Now, let's talk about the world banking system, because you've made the head honcho, Lyndon LaRouche, has made another big call.
Yes,
and
he has.
Quote, the whole world system will go into a chain reaction disintegration, either late this month, so the next couple of weeks, or very early, so within the next 4 weeks, essentially, which is very specific. And like I said before, a lot of people talk about the sky is falling, and you know, they might have mentioned it 30 years ago, and when it finally does happen, they go, I told you, but, you know, it's that doesn't count for anything. But when you talk about that very specific window, that's about as good a call as you're going to get. And it's kind of a brave move as well.
Well, he's saying also, Jeff, that unless something other than stupidity or the prevailing stupidity takes charge. In other words, you can't continue to have a system with enormous amounts of unpayable speculative debt in it. And I've said repeatedly on your show, you know, $1.4 quadrillion worth of debt. And the hotspot right now is in Europe, as people hear these reports on the radio about the enormous debt problems of Europe, where the sovereign debt, that is the debts owned by actual governments running in some cases 125% of their income. Now, the problem is that debt is actually owed, so-called, to the banking system. It's been actually borrowed by governments, like Kevin Rudd borrowed money in order to spend it in stimulus packages into their economy. But these economies have been collapsing, and they can't pay it back.
Now, here's another one of your big calls, which I do like. Talking about the global economic breakdown crisis, you know, you say it's been on it's on a scale not seen since the 14th century Dark Age. Now, that's a big call.
Yeah, but so is the debt. Yes. This debt is so huge. I mean, you're just looking at the exposure of the European banks amongst the Eurozone countries, and that's what, 16 countries? $1.58 trillion, Jeff. I mean, that is a phenomenal amount of debt, and once this is all speculative debt. This is not for the production of high-speed rails. And some of it might be, but majority of it is just speculation.
To do stuff with, yeah.
Do you
agree with what the UK government, I think they've spooked everybody, because the UK is in a fairly wobbly sort of place. It's just come out of recession, and now the government's decided, they've looked at the books and gone, oh, my God. And, okay, it's time for austerity measures, and they're going to, you know, really tighten the screws. Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't make sense at all. It's the same story in every single country around the world trying to deal with this unpayable debt. What they're trying to do is save the banking system, which is unsavable, because all the banks are bankrupt because of the enormous debt loadings that they have and what we call fictitious capital. That is that these things called derivatives, you know, like, the thing that blew apart in 2008, the collateralized debt obligations report down Lehman Brothers, was speculative paper. And there's so much of this stuff in the system that what they're trying to do is, or what they actually did do, is shift the debt burden from between the banks onto governments and the taxpayers.
Where have they borrowed the money from? Well, who's owed the money?
The money is owed as book entries between the different financial institutions that have gone into gambling.
So
right?
I'm just wondering, what would happen if I know someone would lose out because someone's owed a lot of money, and if we just cancelled it, if we just drew a line through it and said, okay, today is day zero. Let's forget about all that, and all the books are square, and let's just pick up from before all this happened.
Well, that's the same thing, and that's exactly what we're calling for. It's called Glass-Steagall. Now, that is a very important name because it is exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933. He had the same problem back then after the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for the Glass-Steagall was to take or to draw a line between the commercial banks in the U.S. and the investment banks. Now, your commercial banks are the banks that lend to businesses. They've got your savings. They've got your mortgages in it. And they were highly regulated before a lot of speculation took place in the Great Depression. And then when Glass-Steagall came in, it re-regulated the banks and says, you've got to spend this money in these ways with these interest rates. And the investment banks, well, if you want to go and gamble with your money in more high-risk stuff, you can go for it. But you can't touch the savings banks and the commercial banks' money.
Hmm.
Well, that was taken apart in successively over a period of time.
Yeah.
Up until basically 1999, where Alan Greenspan was instrumental in repealing the Glass-Steagall Bill. Now, it was on Clinton's watch at that time. Actually, President Clinton was working behind the scenes with Mr. LaRouche in developing a whole new financial architecture, I believe, and that was to move away from this casino banking economy that we've got and actually go back to a more regulated system. Now, of course, Clinton got Monica Lewinsky, didn't he? He got scandalized, he got taken apart and backed off that particular direction.
Oh, right. Yeah. He didn't need any more unpopular sort of press, is that what you're saying?
Well, I think he got smashed.
Right.
In terms of the sort of scandal that was under the now, Lewinsky.
What about here?
Who cares? I mean, who cares about the sex life of a president? And go back to John F. Kennedy and others, and you could dig up a whole seated story. Oh. That's not the role of, that's got nothing to do with actually political politics.
No, but it comes down to character. And political policies, this is a different conversation, but political policies, they're not always cut and dried, it's not all financial stuff. That they do set the moral tone and character of the nation. They're making laws about families and welfare and all this sort of stuff. And you do need to be able to trust and agree fundamentally with who the leader is.
Unfortunately, that was a weakness with Clinton, and it staffed up the potential of not going in the situation that we have today.
What about here in Australia, where they're talking about, when's the guarantee coming off? Sometime soon.
Well, it's come off now.
Oh, okay.
In March, I think.
Right, so we're kind of sailing, aren't we? We're doing pretty well.
We're actually floating in a bit of a risky situation, and the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank made comments today about the fact that they're quite worried about the situation in Europe and can't see it getting any better, and consequently there was no rate rise this month because of that. So the Glass-Steagall principle, Jeff, as you nailed it on the head before, is you say, okay, we have a legitimate economy, we have a physical economy, we have to pay for goods and services, there's a real economy out there, therefore we have to protect any debt that's associated with that economy. The rest of it, the gambling debts, well, no one goes up to the cashier at the end of the when they've been at the casino and says, oh, look, I just lost all my money. Can I have it back? When the government decides that it wants to protect the real wealth, the actual productive side of the economy, it says, and this is what Glass-Steagall would do, you had a gambling debt, you invested in stuff that has no value, wipe it out.
Okay, I can see that. Do you think the government, they've got their hands full with the miners at the moment. Do you think they're going to bring on another fight on their hands?
Well, they may not.
No,
they may not. They may be forced to, Jeff, because we're talking about so much debt that's unpayable. The system itself, as LaRouche has said, is disintegrating. It just can't work anymore. And you've got these funny little cover-ups, you've got these fantastic public announcements about this grand thing called the European Financial Stability Facility. I think it's a great big, enterprise where there's lots of very talented people. Well, there's 15 people in the back room of the Bank of International Settlements sending each other emails. Mm. And that's supposed to solve the problem. The problem is systemic, and it's a result of the huge amounts of speculation and debt in the system.
Well, now, Craig, I've got to leave it there, but if once again, we've got 4 weeks, really, so we'll chat between now and then. We'll count it down.
Well, hopefully the stupidity will end and there'll be some moves made that we may not hear about.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath about the stupidity ending. Now, Craig, if people want to find out more...
Well, look, we cover this stuff all over the place on our website, www.cecaust.com.au. We've got a 1-800 number, 1-800-636-432, and we can send out people some of the latest material, DVDs, all sorts.
Easy. Good talking to you. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Craig. Craig Ishwood from the...